Next case is State versus Torres. Could we have appearances of counsel, please?
Margaret McLean, Assistant Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of Mr. Torres.
Alexander Shalom from the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey as a friend of the court.
Stephen A. Yomtov, Deputy Attorney General for the State of New Jersey.
Thank you, counsel. Chief Justice Ravner will participate in this case. We'll be watching the video of the oral argument. Ms. McLean.
Thank you. Your Honors, may it please the court, and I'd like to reserve just 2 minutes for rebuttal if
sure.
necessary. 3 hours after his arrest, over the course of 20 minutes, a police officer made Mr. Torres remove every single article of clothing he was wearing. The officer made Torres stand in his underwear for more than 10 minutes as the officer photographed him and swabbed his face and hands. Throughout all of this, the door to the interrogation room was open, and there were 2 to 3 police officers in the room or the doorway watching Mr. Torres remove his clothes. The culmination of this humiliating encounter occurred when the officer conducting the search ordered Mr. Torres to remove his underwear, which required Mr. Torres to literally strip naked in front of multiple other people. The police did all of this without any prior judicial authorization. What happened to Mr. Torres was wholly unreasonable. And during this argument, I'd like to focus on kind of 2 primary legal avenues that demonstrate the unreasonableness of this search. First, this was a strip search that violated the clear rules set by the Attorney General in limiting strip searches, and it was thus objectively unreasonable under Article 1, Paragraph 7. Second, in the alternative, it was constitutionally unreasonable because it cannot be justified as a search incident to Mr. Torres' arrest 3 hours earlier. And I'm happy to answer the court's questions on anything, but this case comes down to reasonableness. And it is simply not reasonable to make someone strip completely naked on video in a room with multiple police officers without a warrant or a compelling reason for which the police cannot wait for a warrant.
The only evidence was found on the sweatshirt. Is that correct, Ms. McLean?
Yes. Afterwards, they only found evidence on the sweatshirt. However, this whole thing happened as a continuous
understand.
Search.
But if you had an auto search, for example, you might apply different levels of constitutional analysis to different aspects of it. If there's a container, if there's a search of the trunk, if there's a search of the passenger compartment, is that all correct?
Yes.
So wouldn't we look at the removal of the sweatshirt? I'm not saying we ignore what happened later, but shouldn't we look at the removal of the sweatshirt, which is the act that resulted in the evidence that we're seeking to have suppressed, as a discrete aspect of this for purposes of the constitutional analysis?
No, because that's not what happened. The police officers walked into this room, brought Mr. Torres in, said, "We are going to take some pictures of you and we are going to take all of your clothes." That's what they say at the start of this encounter. And then that is exactly what they did. Without any breaks, they take item by item by item of clothing until he is naked.
Please
go ahead.
Just wondering, chronologically, Ms. McLean, why is the conduct of the police after they get the sweatshirt constitutionally relevant to the exclusionary rule here? Isn't it only the events that led up to the seizure, the improper seizure of that garment? What happened afterwards doesn't affect the analysis, right?
No, this is not a universe in which this is not a factual scenario in which we look at attenuation. This was a single unlawful strip search because they brought Mr. Torres into the room and said, "We are going to take all of your clothes and we are going to take some pictures of you." That's what they did. And we can't splice this by saying, "Oh, well, they only found evidence on the sweatshirt later when they tested it." So the fact that they hypothetically could have taken only his sweatshirt means that what happened here is okay.
But doesn't a motion to suppress, on a motion to suppress, don't you have to identify what was the specific item that was illegally searched or specifically seized. And so here the argument is the sweatshirt was illegally searched and seized. So as Judge Sabatino asked, why would it be relevant what happened after the sweatshirt? Assuming your client, for example, could bring a 1983 claim for money damages about the strip search and how he was subjected to it. But what does that have to do with why the seizure of the sweatshirt would be?
Because we don't splice searches and seizures in that way. The exclusionary rule, the purpose is to deter police from conducting unlawful searches. And the police conducted a single, continuous, unlawful strip search in this case. If all they wanted was this sweatshirt, they should have stopped after taking his sweatshirt. That would have theoretically been okay. But that's not what they did, and that's not what they went into that room planning to do. And we know that because of what they told Mr. Torres. We know that from their actions. We know that from the fact that they did not stop until Mr. Torres was naked in a room.
Does the violation of the strip search statute require the constitutional remedy of the exclusionary rule?
Yes.
Why?
Does
the statute say that, or?
No, but that is what the appellate division has said in Hayes and Harris. That's what this court has implicitly recognized in Evans when considering whether the strip search statute required suppression, granting of the suppression motion in that case.
A violation of the statute equals a constitutional violation automatically.
Yes, violation of the statute is evidence. It demonstrates that the police conduct was objectively unreasonable.
Let me ask you further, though, because there's arguments that, well, the statute doesn't apply for various reasons. This is pursuant to the investigation of a crime and so on. Are you arguing that regardless of whether there is alleged compliance with the strip search statute, are you arguing that constitutional principles that concern strip search invalidate what happened here, regardless of compliance with the statute? Or if the state shows, put another way, if the state shows compliance with the statute, does that eliminate your constitutional claim regarding strip search?
So the state plainly cannot show compliance with the statute because search incident to arrest does not count as an exception. That's what the court said in Hayes. That's the court said that with approval.
Yeah, I know you're going to get to that, but just please answer my question right now so I understand the framework, all right? If you're unsuccessful in showing a violation of the strip search statute, is there still some overarching Fourth Amendment or constitutional or New Jersey constitutionally based doctrine here that says certain strip searches, even if they comply with the statute, are still unconstitutional? Or do you have to prove all, you know, a violation of the statute to get anywhere with that argument?
I apologize if I'm misunderstanding your question. The statute provides more protections than either the Fourth Amendment or Article
7. Oh, okay. All right. So that if you don't show that the statute's been violated, that argument
Doesn't the statute only apply to people? I'm sorry. Doesn't the statute only restrict searches for those who are, quote, detained or arrested for commission of an offense other than a crime?
Yes, and that's why during this argument I was going to ideally try to focus. I'm happy to answer the court's questions, but yes, you are exactly correct. Here, Mr. Torres was arrested on a reckless driving warrant. They make no mention of why he's being arrested or detained until after the strip search is completed when they say, we're going to process you for obstruction and resisting arrest.
I understand that they didn't specifically tell him you are under arrest for murder or you are under arrest for resisting, but didn't they ask him about his stepfather's death and tell him that he was a suspect in the murder during the interrogation, which did precede the search?
Yes, and I would just the Attorney General guidelines apply across the board, and the only other point I'd like to make about the being detained and is this a de facto arrest for something other than this active reckless driving warrant is in State v. Evans, the other strip search case this court has considered. The defendant was arrested for a non-criminal warrant. They then felt what was immediately apparently drugs in his underwear. And this court nonetheless looked at the strip search statute and found that it had been satisfied because the plain feel exception satisfied the statute.
But the drugs were found only during the search in Evans.
The drugs were found, but
what he was being questioned about, and I want to let you finish your questions in a moment. was something they knew about before they asked for the sweatshirt in this case. That's different from Evans, is it not?
So in Evans, they knew because it was immediately apparent that he was concealing crack cocaine in his underwear before they strip searched him. And here he was a suspect in this murder.
Sorry, so you're saying that in Evans, as soon as they saw a bulge in his pants, then he was detained for a crime of possessing cocaine?
I'm saying that this court treated Evans as being decided under the strip search statute, notwithstanding the fact that they felt what was immediately apparently crack cocaine in his underwear.
But no one contested that the strip search statute applied
in Evans, no. In this case,
So in this case, you mentioned that you were also relying on the AG guidelines. Didn't the appellate division in State versus Brown hold that the attorney general could not validly, and I'm quoting, did not validly extend the same search requirements to individuals who are detained or arrested for crimes because doing so exceeded the attorney general's authority?
And that is what the appellate division held. And in my petition, it was my case. We have the same cast of characters, but I petitioned and said the attorney general does have this authority. And in the order denying certification, the order essentially says we do not read the language on pages 15 to 17 of the appellate division opinion to limit the attorney general's authority. Yes, so I would submit that that portion of Brown is not valid. And the attorney general is the chief law enforcement officer of the state. The attorney general it's his job to promulgate guidelines, to regulate police, to set rules for when police can do things for the efficiency of criminal justice, for the administration of law. That is the attorney general's job, and he has chosen to do so, and with respect to strip searches.
That wouldn't determine how far the Constitution would reach.
Correct. The attorney general guidelines don't provide, you know, a guidelines-based suppression remedy. However, the substantive restrictions on this uniquely invasive kind of search that has been set and in place for decades by the chief law enforcement officer of the state of New Jersey are evidence of what is a reasonable search in New Jersey. And if police violate these substantive provisions of the guidelines, if they conduct a search, as they did here, without a warrant, without consent, without exigent circumstances, that is both a violation of the guidelines, but it is also constitutionally unreasonable.
Because any violation of the guidelines, as long as it's substantive, automatically violates the Constitution.
I'm struggling to come up with a way that wouldn't be obviously violating the reporting requirements, perhaps not asking the officer in charge for permission. But if the rules say you need a warrant and the police don't get a warrant, that is unreasonable. And we know it is unreasonable under our Constitution because the chief law enforcement officer of the state has sought to limit when this particularly degrading, humiliating, invasive kind of search can occur.
The AG has guidelines for law enforcement in many different contexts and best practices in many cases. And not everything that the AG says about how law enforcement should conduct itself has constitutional dimension. We agree with that?
Absolutely. But this is why the fact that the Constitution, Article 1, Paragraph 7, requires searches and seizures be reasonable. Reasonableness is the standard. And where our state has limited when certain kinds of searches can occur, violation of those rules is evidence that the police have exceeded what we view as a society as reasonable.
Aren't we talking apples and oranges here? I mean, is the AG, when the AG issues guidelines for something like this, making a predetermination of a constitutional issue?
No, the AG is directing the police officers in the state of New Jersey what the rules are, how they should conduct their jobs. As here, those rules are violated because the police did not have what the Attorney General guidelines told them they needed to have, which are a search warrant, consent, or probable cause and exigent circumstances. That is evidence of unreasonableness. And in this case, that is dispositive evidence of unreasonableness. Police can't...
Going back to the State versus Brown, this court's order denying leave to appeal says, the order noted, quoting, that it does not read the language above to circumscribe the Attorney General's ability to issue appropriate guidelines. But because State versus Brown had found that the guidelines were not appropriate, doesn't that just mean that we are denying leave to appeal because we agree with what the appellate division did here, but we do not read this to otherwise circumscribe the Attorney General's ability to issue other appropriate guidelines? These are not appropriate, so this is not about these guidelines.
So
where do you take from that? Like, how could the court have denied leave to appeal but still overruled the Aptiv's holding?
So the Aptiv's holding was there were exigent circumstances. That's what the Aptiv held in Brown. They said he was wiggling around. We thought he might access a weapon. Those were exigent circumstances that justified the strip search. The statements about the guidelines, the Attorney General in New Jersey has broad authority by statute. Our case law has recognized that when the Attorney General issues guidelines, they're binding on police officers. They can issue guidelines on any number of things. And those guidelines, so long as they relate to kind of law enforcement, enforcement of laws in New Jersey, they don't have to be specifically authorized by, they don't have to be authorized by a specific statute. So, for example, use of force policies.
I guess it just brings it back to what Justice Patterson was asking. If the AG can issue any guidelines that the Attorney General wants to, why does that how could that possibly then determine the constitutionality of anything, or even whether anything would violate a statute? The AG can't enlarge a statute, just like the AG cannot enlarge the Constitution by promulgating guidelines, if, as you say, the AG can promulgate guidelines on anything that he or she wants to.
Yes, and I think there's kind of two different answers, if you bear with me. In Henderson, the Attorney General had issued guidelines about eyewitness identifications. This court recognized those are great. Those are best practices. But violation of those guidelines does not require suppression of an identification. However, it's critical to recognize that the standard for suppressing an identification is an irreparable risk of identification as borne by, which is a burden borne by the defendant after the burden shifting framework. The standard for searches and seizures is always reasonableness. And the rules set by law enforcement in the state of New Jersey are baked into what we as a society recognize as reasonable. If it's reasonableness and privacy and societal expectations all go hand in hand, as this court recognized in Hempel, you expect your garbage, society expects your garbage man to take your garbage. We don't expect the police to open your garbage. All of these things come together because of the particular constitutional prohibition against unreasonable searches and seizures. And again, ultimately, this case does come down to reasonableness. That was the constitutional problem here.
There's nothing in those guidelines that says this is if you do not follow these or some aspect of these, this is unreasonable for purposes of the Fourth Amendment.
No, but as a citizen of New Jersey, it is baked in, it's reasonable for all citizens to expect that police officers will follow the rules set by the chief law enforcement officer.
There could be a civil action under Section 1983 or the New Jersey Civil Rights Act to complain about an improper strip search and obtain monetary or other kinds of relief. And that would certainly deter violations of the policy or the statute. But why is it automatically a constitutional violation that triggers the exclusionary rule that, what evidence is there that that is intended by the legislature to be an exclusionary rule situation and not something that would simply give a right to a civil case?
So I don't. Unless we're back to talking about the strip search statute, I don't think we're talking about really the legislature, and I don't even think we're talking about the Attorney General's intent. The Attorney General, in promulgating...
Well, we are talking about the legislature, because the legislature empowers the Attorney General to issue the guidelines. That's all...
to issue guidelines for the effective enforcement of right. criminal laws and to regulate when police officers can do certain things, when police officers can use force, when police officers can strip people naked.
The statute and the guidelines pertain to offenses that are not 2C crimes, correct?
No. The statute applies to arrests for non-criminal offenses. The guidelines specifically incorporate the statutory provisions, but also apply to anyone arrested in New Jersey who's going to be subjected to a strip search.
Okay, so your argument is it has no bearing whether he was being held on the warrant, or being held because of the investigation of a murder.
Yes.
My second question is, at this point in time, when they took his sweatshirt and other articles of clothing, was the warrant application pending?
No.
When did that happen?
They began the strip search at 6:40 p.m. They finished it right around 7 p.m. They spoke to a judge at 8:03 p.m.
And was that, okay. That's why I wouldn't confirm.
Your argument that the Attorney General determines what is reasonable and therefore a violation of the Attorney General's guidelines automatically violates the Constitution, wouldn't that end up being very harmful in the long run if a different attorney general decided to promulgate regulations saying that all strip searches are reasonable in any and all circumstances because no one has the right to ever be free from a strip search? If the AG's guidelines determine what is reasonable, wouldn't the AG be able to say that the Constitution should be interpreted more narrowly rather than more broadly?
A couple of nitpicky points, and then I promise, address the, I think, what is the real substance of this question. It's not that the guidelines require suppression. And if the Attorney General promulgated different rules that broadened when police
I missed what you said. It's not the guidelines.
The guidelines don't automatically require suppression. Violation of the guidelines is evidence of objective constitutional unreasonableness. Violation, conducting a search without, as the guidelines require, search warrant, consent, probable cause, and exigency is evidence that what happened is constitutionally unreasonable. It's not that the guidelines demand suppression. It's not that violation of the guidelines demand suppression. It's that the guidelines demonstrate are evidence of what society views as a reasonable search. And expectations of privacy, reasonableness can change over time. It is possible that the Attorney General could issue new guidelines that say, free for all. You can strip search everyone, not except for the specific limitations set by the legislature in the strip search statute. However, that would still be constitutionally unreasonable. And that kind of transitions us, if this court is okay with it, to the search incident to arrest warrant exception, which is the state's primary justification for this.
Coming back to the chronology again, if the police hypothetically had stopped once they asked him to take off his jacket, and he complied, and they had not gone no further in asking him to disrobe, would that be an unconstitutional strip search?
No.
All right, so why are the post-jacket events germane to our evaluation of whether there really wasn't much of a request, the demand to take off your jacket was unconstitutional?
Because this court has not ever and should not now start parsing continuous police actions.
We do
in
that
this
all
way.
The time in container searches in an automobile. We look at the steps that the officer took, snapshot by snapshot, and evaluate at that point, did the officer violate the Constitution as we go through and decide what has to be excluded. Let me give you an example right about this case. If incident to arrest, they had patted him down and found a gun or contraband, and then continued to then ask him to disrobe, etc., there'd be no way to say the violation of the strip search policies has any bearing on the constitutionality of taking incident to his arrest through a pat down some contraband, right? That would be, that step of it was constitutional in my hypothetical, right? A normal pat down, yes?
If Yes, I believe so. The problem here...
I'd say it was a Terry stop, even. I mean, something, just presume for purposes of my question, they constitutionally, at an early phase of the sequence of events, constitutionally see something. How does what happened afterwards matter to that particular action?
Because in this case, the action at issue is that entire 20-minute evidence collection video. That's the action.
Why is that? Because we have a case right now, I think it's about plain smell. And I think the argument from the Office of the Public Defender in that case is that there has to be separate probable cause to search every different part of the vehicle. So there has to be separate individual probable cause to search the passenger compartment, then there has to be separate probable cause to search the engine compartment, I think it is in that case, and then there has to be separate probable cause to search the trunk in that compartment. And it cannot just be that there was a smell of raw marijuana emanating from the vehicle. There, the search also, I think, took place in a lot less than 20 minutes. So why here is it, you can't separate it, the sweatshirt was exactly the same as him being naked and photographed, but there it's, each thing is separate and you have to have separate probable cause for every step of the search, even if it only took 5 minutes.
Because I think they found blood evidence on the sweatshirt, but the police intended, I know we don't look at subjective intent, but their actions demonstrate, along with their words, that they were going to do this entire thing from start to finish.
Well, there are some instances, going back to the car example, I think Justice Patterson started off with kind of the car example. There are some instances where you can say the same for police action in a car, search of a car, that, you know, the police see something in plain view, they search the passenger compartment, but then move and see some evidence, but then move to the trunk. And in those instances, sometimes we do parse through the evidence that was found in the passenger compartment versus the evidence that was found in the trunk. And you can make the same argument. Well, the officers were dead set on doing an entire search from start to finish of the vehicle. So how does, you know, not being, how does your argument that we can't parse out the different evidence that was seized, the sweatshirt and everything else, how does that work in terms of some of our other cases where we do that with cars?
So it's a search under our Constitution if police invade an expectation of reasonable, societally recognized reasonable expectation.
In both cases, right? Both cases, both are searches.
Yes, so it's a search. And the question is, was that search lawful or not? If it's unlawful, then the evidence found as a result of that search must be suppressed. In this case, the evidence found as a result of the search is the blood spatter on the sweatshirt. So that has to be suppressed. But that doesn't mean that the police didn't... That doesn't mean that just because what they ultimately found as evidence could have been taken in some hypothetically other lawful search, what happened here is okay.
Car search in plain view, to use Justice Pierre-Louis's example, in plain view, there's clearly contraband there. So that's taken. And the police officer's saying, we're going to search, let's everybody get together, we're going to search the entire car. I would respectfully suggest, and you're one of our outstanding advocates here, that even if the plain view had no issues whatsoever and that particular evidence was clearly coming in, not suppressed, you would be arguing that on stage 4, 5, or 6, that there was a crossing of a boundary that would affect the evidence found in the container, in the glove compartment, in the trunk, next to the engine compartment, whatever it would be, as a distinct phase of the same overall continuous search. And what I'm not understanding is, what's the distinction between those two?
Because, again, to come back to it, the blood evidence on the sweatshirt is the fruit of the unlawful strip search.
But you would not be arguing that the contraband found in the console in plain view should be suppressed because it was the fruit of something that some aspect later that crossed the constitutional line. I mean, just literally dozens and dozens and dozens of cases in which you and your officer are very effectively arguing for separately analyzing stages and not saying that because stage one was either constitutional or not constitutional, that that impacts on the rest of it. And this is a search. I mean, that's clearly it. It's treated as a search, such as a car search would be or a search of a home. It is a search with different stages to it.
Respectfully, that's not how the police treated it. That's not what the video shows it as. And that matters. The police, just because they could have done it right, doesn't mean they can walk into a room, say, I'm going to take all of your clothes and I'm going to take pictures of you in your underwear. Okay, let's go.
Does it matter that all of this clothing was going to be seized, taken, and evaluated when he hit the jail?
No, because that's kind of an inevitable discovery sort of argument. That is an inevitable discovery argument. The trial court never ruled on that. And also, importantly, the state and the trial court has never actually advanced that argument. Their justification for inevitable discovery was we would have gotten a search warrant, and that's not allowed under inevitable discovery. So this court would be filling in gaps in a record in favor of the party with the burden of proof, and that's not something that courts
do. Does it have any bearing on the reasonableness of the strip search in this case? The fact that essentially that's what was about to happen anyway when he got transferred to the jail.
So, no, because it does not bear on the reasonableness of the search, because to balance reasonableness, we look on the actual intrusion on the defendant's privacy rights balanced against the state's interest.
Maybe you're making the argument harder for yourself than you need to, or we are. So let's go to the search incident to arrest aspect of it, where you started out telling us that, you know, this occurred about 3 hours after he was deprived of his liberty, and that the normal justifications for a search incident to arrest, destruction of evidence, safety of the officers, is not reasonably implicated here to justify what they did, that there was no necessity at that point, even if they had probable cause, there's no necessity for them to take his jacket at the time they did while they were waiting for the warrant. Well, if we went into that issue, we know Edwards sets up a federal Fourth Amendment standard, and the case is from a long time ago. Am I correct? You're arguing that under the New Jersey Constitution, we should be more protective of citizens' rights, and that 3 hours later, under the circumstances here, is not a justified period of time, both in terms of delay and scope, to fit the search incident to arrest. Is that correct, as I understand it, what your argument is there?
Yes, Your Honor. As this court did in Echol, under Article 1, Paragraph 7, we provide more protection than the Fourth Amendment, generally speaking. And the search incident to arrest exception is, as Your Honor pointed out, tethered to its purposes. That's why you don't need anything more than the mere fact of a valid arrest. That's all you need for a search incident to arrest. And to say that hours and hours and hours later, that justification still applies, fully untethers the exception from its purpose.
And they say on the, if you watch, I'm sorry.
No, please.
Just if you're watching the video, I've looked at it, the two videos, you see him picking at his fingernails. You see a few points where he's rubbing his hands, not on his sweatshirt, I didn't see, but on his pants. And that accelerated the need, according to the state, to not wait for the warrant and ask him to disrobe. Those actions by him during the interview provide the state with the kind of emergency justification that's required?
No, because they still waited 2 hours after seeing him picking his hands. And also, just as a person who fidgets a lot, as a person who picks at my hands, it's...
Are we responsible for that?
No, not at all. Not at all. But it's really unclear how me picking at my fingers or the defendant picking at his fingers could have affected potential biological evidence on a sweatshirt. The state didn't present evidence as to how that could happen, and that's...
I think the theory was, which the appellate division agreed with, was that he was trying to remove from his hands biological evidence.
And if that's the case, Then, as in Lentz, where they were able to swab his hands for gunshot residue, this uniquely kind of fragile type of evidence, perhaps they could have swabbed his hands. It's a minimally invasive search. There is this compelling state justification, but it doesn't
the
follow
theory,
through
the theory, I think,
sweatshirt.
Was is he's trying to get something off his hands. It may, whatever that is, blood or whatever, DNA, could also be on his sweatshirt, and we therefore can't afford to wait for a warrant on this.
If they couldn't afford to wait for a warrant, they shouldn't have waited 3 hours. They shouldn't have waited 2 hours after seeing him pick his hands. They did
the waiting, the 3 hours and the 2 hours. So they have the interrogation, as far as I understand it, ends at about 5 p.m. And there are times at the on the video at 4:45 p.m., 4:41 p.m., where you can see the defendant either picking his hands, but sometimes actually rubbing his hands in a way that seems less, I agree, that I and certainly my children can be prone to hand picking, but there are times on the video where it doesn't look like it's necessarily hand picking as much as hand rubbing, whatever. Then it's 5 o'clock. Then I think in the officer's testimony, then he goes to his supervisor. Then they call the assistant prosecutor and say that they want to get a warrant. So when you mentioned before that the application for the warrant hadn't begun at the time at 6:42 p.m., I think that depends when you consider an application for a warrant to have begun. I think the officer testified that on their end, you know, they started the application by calling the assistant prosecutor and telling the prosecutor they wanted to get a warrant. Then he explained, I think the prosecutor has to call the judge. The prosecutor calls the sheriff's office, then a whole chain. And then by the time they get the judge back on the phone, you mentioned that it's 8 p.m. But so it's, it doesn't seem, at least from the officer's testimony, that between 5 p.m. and 6:42 p.m., they were just sitting on their hands or dealing with something else. It does seem like they were moving with haste to try to create a situation whereby they could swab his hands and take his garments because they believe that there is blood on them.
The question isn't whether the police were acting with haste, whether they were going through this process. The question is, at 6:40 p.m., when they make the decision to take his clothes without a warrant, was that, at that point, did they have a reason to stop waiting? Had anything changed at that point? And the answer to that is no. If they really were concerned about the handpicking and they knew they weren't going to wait for a warrant, they could have done that. They should have done that if they were really concerned that there was this dissipation of evidence shortly after seeing this thing. But they didn't do that. They'd arrested Mr. Torres shortly before 4 p.m. They searched him on scene at the truck before bringing him to a police station. They Mirandize him, interrogate him. The interrogation ends, and an hour and 40 minutes later, with nothing kind of triggering the reason why they had to do it then, as opposed to do what they'd been doing and continue waiting for the search warrant, they decided to take all of his clothes. And there's no compelling state justification at the 3 hour mark, as opposed to at the 4 hour mark, at the 5 hour mark. They've been safely maintaining the status quo and should have continued to do so rather than take his clothing, rather than try to claim that what happened here is justified by his arrest hours earlier. It would untether the exception from its core purposes, and that's something this court should not do.
It's not been argued by the state here, but whatever this court does about the issues that are presented, would it be appropriate for the court to say, we're not addressing, because it wasn't before us, whether there's some administrative justification, such as when we're investigating a homicide and it's a prime suspect, we routinely, in every instance, require the suspect to remove their clothing in exchange and put on prison garb or something. If that were the, I'm hypothesizing, if that were the policy, we're not going to, in this case, it wouldn't be appropriate to say that we're ruling that out. We would just have to ignore that for purposes of this opinion, right?
In this case, because what the police officers did was choose to conduct abruptly change what they had been doing and conduct this search in an interrogation room at the police station, there's no reason to discuss what could have conceivably happened.
But an administrative search would be a different analysis, right?
It would be a different analysis. If we're talking about strip searches, they are covered under the Attorney General guidelines under the custodial confinement section. But that would be a different case here. And those are much more tied to the institutional security needs of looking for weapons, drugs, and contraband, which is why you can do them, generally speaking, on reasonable suspicion rather than probable cause. But it's tied to institutional security, which we don't have here. He's at a police station in an interrogation room.
When Judge Sabatino asked you earlier about inevitable discovery, or it actually might have been Justice Solomon, because the defendant was going to be transferred and was transferred to the Middlesex County Adult Correction Center, it sounded like you said the state waived that. They never argued inevitable discovery. Is that correct?
They argued inevitable discovery, but they argued inevitable discovery on the basis that while we would have gotten a warrant, look, we did get a warrant a little while later, and you can't use inevitable discovery to circumvent the warrant requirement because otherwise police officers would be allowed to or would start conducting searches whenever they thought they had probable cause, and if they felt that they found evidence, they'd then go and apply for a search warrant
That's not a valid, I know you don't agree with that argument in this case, but it's not a valid inevitable discovery argument to say we were in the process of getting a warrant and would have gotten one quickly? That's an argument that we've seen in a number of cases, isn't it?
I think it gets really dicey.
But there's no categorical prohibition on that argument.
As courts have said, the court in Lashley said, the warrant requirement is not supposed to be this procedural speed bump that officers...
Understood, as a general proposition, but yes. To be clear, there is this, at least this court, tell me if I'm wrong, has never ruled that that category of inevitable discovery argument is an invalid argument, have we?
No, however, the circumstances under which courts have kind of found that to be a valid argument generally involve two sets of officers. One set of officers that do an illegal search while another officer was actually in the process of typing up an affidavit and only found out later on that their colleagues had jumped the gun and conducted an illegal search. It's where we're asking, where we're looking at the same officers, we don't have two sets of officers. It's going to be very, very difficult for the state to prove that these police officers, by clear and convincing evidence, that these police officers who chose to conduct an illegal search would have instead applied for a warrant.
They were in the process of getting the warrant. I thought they had engaged in getting a telephonic warrant, but the problem was from the time the interview ended until the time the search was done, the electronics, the court smart, they had trouble with. It was a new process, not uncommon back in those days at the trial level. And that was all going on at the same time. And I thought at that point they were concerned he could go to the bathroom, hours had passed, go to the bathroom, wash his hands, wash off material in his clothing, that they could lose what they stood to get. I thought all of that was going on at the same time. And of course it was the same officers. They were talking to the court, they were talking to the sheriff, they were talking to the prosecutor.
The question is,
am I right or am I wrong?
So it is the same officer, and the trial judge
officers.
Notes... Officers, yes, it is the same. Detective Marshak is the officer who testified at the suppression hearing. Sergeant Knapp is the one who did the search. But there are multiple officers. But the question is not, could the police have done this the right way if they'd done it wrong? It's that, would the state have actually followed...
You're missing my point. They had already started that process. They were on the phone with the court. They had actually, I thought at one point, they thought they were in a position to get the warrant, but there was an electronic failure and the record of what they told the judge was lost and they had to do it again. All of that was going on at the same time while they were concerned about losing evidence. Am I wrong? I could be. It's happened before.
I don't recall about specifically losing the... having actually spoken to a judge. My recollection of the record is they spoke to a judge at 8 p.m. after the search was completed. But the question...
I think there was some issue with the electronic system with getting the charges filed.
Yes, it was... Three days after the CJRA, so they had difficulty...
They had already spoken to the assistant prosecutor and said, we want to apply for the warrant, and then the assistant prosecutor was the one who then calls the sheriff's office, and then the sheriff calls the judge, and then the judge calls the sheriff, and then the sheriff calls the assistant prosecutor, and then the assistant prosecutor brings everyone in the room.
Yes. Again, though, the point is not... Is there... The question for inevitable discovery is, can the state prove by clear and convincing evidence that police would have followed these proper specific procedures of getting everyone on the phone and applying for a search warrant when what they actually did, when that was an available option to them, what they chose to do instead was conduct an unlawful search. And I would submit that they cannot do that here.
In terms of the inevitable discovery argument about the jail and your argument that the state can't rely on that now because they only argued before the trial court that it was inevitable discovery as to getting a warrant, didn't your client never argue a strip search before the trial court?
No, we did argue, or not we, but the defense did argue that it was a strip search, and we know that that issue was sufficiently raised because the prosecutor at the oral argument on the suppression issue said, I did more research last night. I am no longer arguing that they could have conducted a strip search on the ATS warrant as they did. So the prosecutor was on notice. That kind of notice is all that's required.
So what was the citation, I'm sorry, in the record for where your client raised a strip search issue? I agree with you that I did see that the prosecutor mentioned the word strip search one time, but I'm asking where did your client raise that this was an illegal strip search before the motion to suppress or before the trial court?
Defense filed a motion to suppress. The state filed a brief raising search and suppress inevitable discovery because we would have gotten a warrant. Defense counsel responds, you can't strip search. Mentions that it's a strip search in the statement of facts, says it's not a contemporaneous search incident to arrest, also says inevitable discovery doesn't apply. And that's how burdens work. The state bears the burden, and the state gets to justify what happened, and the defense gets to respond to that. And
I'm sorry, say it one more time. So in the original motion to suppress, the defendant says this was an illegal strip search. Where is that in the record?
It is in the... Sorry, I have to find the correct tab. It is in the state's trial court brief, defense trial court brief, at DA 11, so the appendix to my original appellate division brief. It has the defense trial court response brief. So this is the response to the prosecutor's brief in that case, because the state went first as the party bearing the burden. In the case at bar, Mr. Torres was strip searched by the seizure of his clothing. And we know that that was good enough to provide notice to the prosecutor that this was, in fact, a strip search, because at page 114 of the suppression transcript, the state says, she says, so I cannot stand by the proposition that we would have been permitted to do a strip search as they did on an ATS warrant. That is actually not the state of the law. So that part of it, I don't think it's appropriate for me to argue. So this
and was... Was that part of the appeal to the appellate division? I understand that the argument was about the search incident to arrest issue on this post-remand portion of the case.
Post-remand, it was exclusively about search incident to arrest because the first appellate division opinion said that it wasn't a strip search because it wasn't for the purpose of examining him in his underwear. So they precluded the strip search argument. They said what happened here is not a strip search because even though the police took pictures of him, that's not sufficient for it being for the purpose of looking at his underwear.
And you didn't file a cert petition after the final judgment of the appellate division?
No, because the appellate division had remanded for the trial court to consider whether to make explicit findings to determine whether this could be justified as a search incident to arrest or under inevitable discovery.
It wouldn't be a petition, right? It would be a motion for leave to appeal the interlocutory determination of the APTIV, right?
Yes, and particularly where it was going to go back down to the trial court and then back up to the appellate division, it seemed most efficient for everyone.
So you're arguing you're not procedurally barred because it wasn't a final judgment that decided the case in its totality. It was an interlocutory determination that was pending this remand. You are arguing you didn't have to preserve the issue. You're saying we didn't have to move for leave to appeal what the appellate division did, right?
Correct.
So what about Rule 2:2-5? that says a judgment of the appellate division on an appeal to it from a final judgment shall be reviewable by the Supreme Court on certification or when appropriate as of right, notwithstanding the remand of the matter by the appellate division for further proceedings.
I'm not saying that I couldn't have petitioned from that. I made the assessment that particularly as this was going back down to the trial court was going to issue a new opinion, and then the appellate division reinstated the old appeal. This isn't a new appeal from a new trial court decision. This is a reinstatement of the original appeal. So it's the same.
They retained jurisdiction?
They didn't retain jurisdiction, but they filed the motion to reinstate the old appeal. So it's the same docket number, same appeal, same everything. We didn't, the second time around, file a brief, a response, a reply. It was a supplemental brief with a page limit and a tight timeline. It was the same appeal. And from that single case, I filed this petition with this court.
Any other questions? You'll be back on remand.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Rebuttal. Ms. McLean, Mr. Shalom.
May it please the court, I'm happy to answer questions about any of the substance, but really the where we just left off is what I briefed and what I'd like to focus on, because I found the appellate division's invocation of the idea of waiver to be deeply troubling and totally contrary to a longstanding and proud tradition in New Jersey of reaching merits adjudications rather than finding matters to be procedurally defaulted. That's been true at least since Preciosi, and Witt did not change that. What Witt said is, in essence, we got to play fair here. And it wasn't fair in Witt, according to this court, to ask the state to prove the validity of the stop when they weren't on notice that that was at issue. And here, there is no doubt as to whether or not the prosecutor was on notice that the strip, that the defendant alleged that this was a strip search. They were on notice because it was in the defendant's brief, and they were on notice because they acknowledged they were on notice at the culmination of the motion to suppress. That's all that we require. It was there. They knew what the landscape was, and they had the burden to prove that the search was valid under that landscape. That's it. And so to be overly pedantic and say, well, it was in the statement of facts, not raised as an argument, is something this court has never done, because we believe, this court believes, and has taught us as practitioners to believe, that New Jerseyans benefit from merits adjudications of important controversies rather than procedural default. And that's not the norm in other states. I will say the first time I read Preciosi, having just done some practice in Alabama where their guideline is default everything, never reach the merits, Preciosi was a breath of fresh air. But the idea invoked in the appellate division's first opinion and relied upon by the state that this was waiver is totally contrary to that.
What would be the appropriate vehicle for review to have been sought after the first appellate division ruling? Would it have been an optional motion for leave to appeal, or would it have been a mandatory petition?
I think it would have been an optional motion. I mean, it is an interlocutory order at the end of the day.
What about the language that Justice Wiener read to you?
I was thinking through it. So it may have been that Ms. McLean was permitted to file a petition, but that is a fundamentally separate question about whether or not her failure to file that results in waiving the argument. That's something this court, I mean, think about, for example, the various routes to certiorari. That you had an opportunity to file it doesn't mean you're procedurally defaulted for failing to do so, at least in state law. Again, federal law looks for default, looks for state procedural defaults, and this court has, for a quarter century, said no. If we can reach the merits, we're going to reach the merits. But this isn't even a question where I'm asking for equities to say it. Here, we know that the prosecutor knew this was what the case was about, because she said it, and it was in the defendant's brief. So if we're going to make a rule that says, well, the statement of facts isn't enough, what is sufficient? I mean, the appellate division kind of adopts the erroneous designation of the brief as a reply brief, the original brief filed by the defendant in the trial court. But it wasn't a reply brief, it was a response brief. It was the only brief filed in the trial court by the defendant. And I just, how much is enough?
How does that apply at all to the argument that the state procedurally defaulted on the inevitable discovery at the jail?
It's about burdens, Justice Wainwright. And so it's not that the state procedurally defaulted. It's that the state doesn't, if there's enough in the record for the court to find inevitable discovery, they can. Because the defendant had the chance to argue it here fairly. What they didn't have a chance to do was say, no, it's actually not true. They don't always seize the pants. Sometimes people can keep the pants. The record is devoid of that.
Sorry, so you're saying that at the Middlesex County Adult Correction Center, when people are booked on charges of murder, the issue here is that they didn't get to make a record that some of those people can keep their sweatshirts?
That inevitable discovery requires a record. I agree with your instinct, the skepticism I hear in your voice, that it's unlikely that that happens. But we also don't know what happens. Can family members pick up the clothing? The fact that it goes into evidence immediately, because it might be that they can pick up your wallet, they can pick up your house keys. We simply don't know. The party with the burden was the state, and they failed to establish that at the trial court, which is when they were required to do it. And so all I'm suggesting is that if you have enough information to make the decision, you can, but a remand to allow them to now advance a different inevitable discovery argument is giving them a second bite at the apple in contravention of traditional rules of burdens in motions to suppress.
If I'm remembering correctly, maybe you and Ms. McClain both made the point, too, that in terms of efficiency, there's a remand where the record would be developed perhaps in a more fulsome way factually to grant Supreme Court review at that time would be less advantageous than waiting to see how a fuller record, fuller examination of everything would play out and then consider the related issues all at once at the end of the process,
Judge, right? Judge Sabatino, that's how I've always understood the disfavoring of interlocutory review is, well, this might get fixed beforehand. So why would, sometimes we look at things because we need to, but if a lower court is going to review something and might fix the error, a court like yours that has a limited docket and lots of people who want their attention, we try, when we bring cases, to only bring cases when the resolution is necessary. And that's why there's a disfavoring of interlocutory review. And I think in this instance, it would be an interlocutory order. And that's why it wasn't appealed, petitioned for at that time.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shalom. Mr. Yamtov?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, I just have a few very brief opening remarks. There's only one legal issue in this case, whether blood evidence from an outer sweatshirt of a prime suspect in a brutal and bloody axe murder should be suppressed. To be clear, this case is not about a hand swab. It's not about photographing. It's not about a strip search or any clothing that was removed after the sweatshirt. And it's certainly not about a person being searched on simply an outstanding traffic warrant. The only question is whether the exclusionary rule applies to the one piece of incriminating evidence, the blood evidence that was found on defendant's zippered sweatshirt. There are three independent reasons why the blood evidence on defendant's sweatshirt should not be suppressed. It was lawfully seized incident to arrest. There were exigent circumstances, and the defendant's clothing would have inevitably been seized upon incarceration at the county jail on the more serious charges. That completes my brief opening remarks. If the court has any questions at this point, I'm going to jump right into responding to some of the briefs. But if you're
why don't we start with waiver?
Okay, waiver.
It's a threshold question.
Mm-hmm.
What is your response to counsel's argument, both counsel, and particularly the argument made by Mr. Shalom?
With respect to the strip search or with respect to?
With respect to the strip search okay. issue.
With respect to what happened below was whether it's characterized as a reply brief or an initial brief, all that it merely mentioned that defendant was strip searched. That's all it was. It was like in the statement of facts. It didn't cite to any of the statutory provisions of the New Jersey strip search.
And that's the statute. Reference that your colleague made to A11, I think she said. And so your argument is that there was no argument made that is
no legal argument. It's just I think what they were basically arguing was just that you look at the term strip search. Yes, the removal of clothing is the stripping, but the search was not part of it. That's one way of looking at this case, to get into the merits of it, that there was no search. There was no visual inspection for the purpose of looking at defendant's undergarments or any of his private areas. And if I could just continue back to the waiver argument, in terms of the prosecutor's remark, that was just an offhand comment during argument. I believe a counsel cited to it. I think, if I'm mistaken, it's on page 1. Was it on 114, I believe, of the motion to suppress transcript, where she was just essentially saying that if this were a traffic warrant, if the defendant was arrested based on a traffic warrant, no, we would not have had authority to strip defendant's clothes under the Strip Search Act. And why she said that, I don't know. But it really, what we have here is really not much to say that this issue was preserved under our.
And the prosecutor said that after the brief made a reference in the statement of facts to a strip search.
Correct. If I could just get the transcript, I have it right here. It's on page 114 of the 1T, which is the April 24, 2018. And it's this paragraph between lines 4 and 17, where a lot of information is revealed here. She's talking about where the swabs were not tested and that the sweatshirt was really the sole focus of the police investigation. In terms of what was taken for, you know, that ended up having incriminating evidence on it. And then later on, she just says that, so I cannot stand by the proposition that we would have been permitted to do a strip search as they did on an ATS warrant. If that's not the state of the law, so that part of it, I don't think it's appropriate for me to argue. I think she was just saying that we can't rely on the strip search statute. But if you want me to address the merits, I'd be
happy. No, please do.
Okay.
Get clarification of this AG's position concerning the failure to seek immediate Supreme Court review of the first appellate division opinion. Are you contending that the defendant had an obligation at that point to pursue relief, and maybe you can tell me what kind of relief, whether a petition or a motion for leave to appeal, after the appellate division, first time around, remands for further proceedings. Was the defendant obligated to file something here in order to preserve the issue for today?
Well, just based on my knowledge of appellate procedure, at that point, since appellate division in Torres 1 ruled that the strip search statute did not apply. They did reach the merits of it, in all fairness.
That was not a final judgment, was it?
Well, it was a...
only partial. It didn't resolve all issues to all parties, right?
I mean, you could look at it as, I've always interpreted, and I'm just talking off the cuff here, right? As when you have an interlocutory order, usually that is from a trial court. And once interlocutory, always, it remains interlocutory. Here, we have a scenario, a hybrid. We have an appellate division remand making a legal determination for a remand. The remand is the judgment. So appeals are taken from judgments, not from reasons. So I don't know if
this scenario... Are you saying that if it were pretrial, if this were all played out pretrial, the whole thing would be interlocutory? It would always be interlocutory if it were going back for a trial.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So, but we have here a guilty plea and then an appeal on this motion to suppress.
Correct.
The appellate division remands, doesn't retain jurisdiction. Is going back to Judge Sabatino's question, is it, from the defendant's perspective, is it a petition for certification if they wanted to do something at that point, or MLA?
In all fairness, I mean, if we look at, very often when we look at petitions and conclusion pages, it says that the judgment of the appellate division should be affirmed or reversed. So in this case, as I'm interpreting it, the remand is the judgment. So if counsel were to challenge the legal ruling, I don't know what category that would fit under, whether it would be an interlocutory order, but it's not an order.
How do you respond to defense counsel's argument that the appellate division reinstated the same appeal, same number, same case, and that's what she filed a petition for certification on, that it was the same case we're under at the appellate level?
That's one interpretation. In all fairness, the state...
Have you had that experience before?
I don't know. I mean, if I've had that experience, the answer is no. Whether the Attorney General's office or the county I don't know.
But Judge Sabatino asked you, is it the AG's, the state's contention that this was waived? Am I correct in interpreting your view on that as not certain?
On the trial issue, I stand by that it is waived. On the appellate issue from Torres 1, I'm uncertain. I think that's the...
So it was waived at the trial because it was not raised in anything other...
I mean, in all fairness, we didn't oppose the petition on that ground. So, I mean, I don't know the answer to that question. And it's something... I don't think the state is, at this point, for the purposes of this case, I can't speak for going forward in future cases. I don't think it really matters because I think we have a strong enough case on the merits.
Why don't you get to the merits, then?
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Sorry?
I'm sorry.
I was waiting for that.
Okay. All right.
First idea is credited all day. So.
Just bear with me because there's a lot of things going on. In this case, and I have some roadmaps here. With respect to the seizure of the sweatshirt, and counsel talked about this single continuous, it was the strip search. The strip search is the constitutional violation, therefore everything after the commencement of the strip search should be. And again, that's just not a recognized principle of standard search and seizure law. We look at when the constitutional violation occurred, in this case, and it's the state's position that nothing was removed at that point that was of any significance in terms of the strip search statute. In fact, his zippered sweatshirt, he had a T-shirt, if you watch the video, it's a T-shirt underneath. It's the equivalent of a coat, a jacket, which is statutorily excluded from the strip search statute. So...
So Ms. McLean has focused on the police officer saying we're going to do this process, mm-hmm. and is in response to our questioning has distinguished that from a car search, which mm-hmm. takes place in stages, to say that because the police had the intent to eventually mm-hmm. get to the point where there would be potential implications under the strip search statute, the whole thing is one unitary, indivisible process. What's your response to that?
I would say that we're dealing with a brutal, bloody murder case here. And irrespective of the blood stain that was eventually located on the sweatshirt, all of the defendant's clothing had to have been removed because any of the... Because I believe counsel had said that they should have stopped with the sweatshirt.
What I'm suggesting, talking about with Ms. McLean's argument is the argument that you don't stop with what happened with the sweatshirt because, and just evaluate the act of removing the sweatshirt, which you've just addressed mm-hmm. based on the statute, because the police officer said we are going to go further and do other things, therefore we can't separate out the sweatshirt. Mm-hmm. What's your response to that?
Well, I think that any time that the police engage in conduct, you have to take, it's like the film. You got to look at each snapshot. You got to look at each step to see if the police, see that the police met the constitutional standard for each level of intrusion, so to speak.
So what was the, you mentioned this term earlier, what was the exigency at that snapshot in time? At that moment, what was so urgent to ask him to remove his sweatshirt that necessitated that and not waiting for the warrant? What was so exigent at that moment?
Well, as we're all aware, in this case, the defendant is actually... ticking his fingers, rubbing his hands. He could be destroying biological evidence that was on his hand. So naturally, the hand swab should have been
done. Not about
the
hand swab. You just told us we look at every phase of it bit by bit. So I'm asking only about the sweatshirt.
Okay.
What was so exigent at that point to demand him to take his sweatshirt? I mean, he would not have been able to discard it in the headquarters. They would have been able to find it. They were able to watch him the whole time. He was in the room with multiple officers.
What was
the danger of destruction of the sweatshirt?
Right. It was a bloody murder scene. The defendant at any point could have said, I got to use the bathroom. And, at that point, he would possibly wash his hands. And it could be intentional. It could be unintentional where water could contaminate, other substances could, attach themselves to the clothing.
The moment they got it from him, he had not made a request to go to the bathroom.
No, but I don't think...
You're hypothesizing something that didn't occur, though, when you say that.
But he was
under 100% surveillance with one or two officers. Oh, well, I guess there were times when they both left the room. That's right. But mm-hmm. they were filming him. They could see him at all times. If he was trying to discard the sweatshirt.
Well, I think as more time passed, there was the risk, a greater risk, that whatever evidence, biological evidence that could have been on his fingers, hands, clothing, could have been destroyed. Just because he didn't ask at 6:41, I have to use the restroom, doesn't mean that at 8 o'clock, right before he's about to be transported to the county jail, that he does use the bathroom. I mean, the point of exigency is one of urgency, that you need to seize the clothing, collect the evidence before it's in any way contaminated.
You would agree on the video, there's no indication or place where you see him wiping his hands on the jacket, correct? There's no spot in the video.
Correct.
Your brief doesn't identify the spot, right?
Correct. And that's why I was saying about the hand swab, even though the hand swab wasn't tested, we still needed to do this. It was not just the hand swab, there was the ear swab, and there was also the hair swab.
Is there evidence of concern that just by taking off the jacket, touching...
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Dried blood could have been...
Absolutely. Absolutely. And other substances, if they gave him a snack... You know,
there was also a suggestion in the video that he was rubbing his hands in his pocket.
I'm sorry, I am here.
I thought on the video there was also a suggestion that he was rubbing his hands inside of his pockets, and the pockets were of the sweatshirt.
I don't recall that. I do know that I know in one of the police reports, it's in my... the state's appellate division, first appellate division brief, I believe it was PA 49, where we actually, we included the police report, and it said that one of the officers saw a stain on the sweatshirt.
Why weren't his hand swabs tested? I just wonder. I mean, so much was made about the fact that he was rubbing his fingers and it looked like he was trying to get rid of evidence, and then
I don't
know.
Tested. I don't know why the hand swab, why that wasn't tested. So,
but again, even if there was a stain that was visible, what was the urgency to take it at that time?
Because I think any time there's DNA evidence or biological evidence on a person's body, on their person, it needs to be removed ASAP. So they made the determination, and as the court has known, there were steps that were taken, reasonable steps during that time to get a warrant, but there were technological issues that arose. It was the fourth day of criminal justice reform. We couldn't, the court smart machine wasn't working.
This was during the process that they were seeking a warrant.
Correct.
I was trying to recall exactly that sequence, that they contacted the prosecutor and began the process around 5-something when the interrogation ended.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Yes.
And that is when the prosecutor and others tried to get a hold of the judge into a telephonic warrant. What's the sequence? Because
What happened was, and I have a timeline here. What happened was, right after the interview ended, the detective Marchak started. He contacted his senior officers, some of who were still at the scene, had to discuss what he observed with the defendant picking and rubbing his hands. Then he contacted the AP, which took time. Then I believe Sergeant Knapp may have been, I don't know for sure, but he had to come to this police station. He was the evidence collection officer. So like Judge Jimenez said, there were a lot of moving parts, a lot of people doing different things. And an hour, you know, between the hour, let me see, it was the removal of 7:03, and it's not until about an hour later that they actually started the actual approval process. So... I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm talking about the end of the interview. At the end of the interview, that's when they started the process of attempting to reach the... And that was the hour-and-a-half gap.
The who? They attempted to reach the who at the end of the interview process? The judge?
Well, they attempted to reach a judge, but they weren't able to get to that point until about 8 o'clock.
They weren't able to... reach the judge or try to reach the judge? I'll look back to the record. I thought there had been interaction between the officers, the prosecutor, the sheriff's department, and the court, and that over the course of about 2 hours or so, the court was having trouble getting the recorded record of the statements of the officers to issue the telephonic warrant, but ultimately that was done around 8 o'clock. So that 3 hours, 2+ hours of it was consumed trying to get the warrant.
Absolutely. That is correct.
And that ties in with your exigency point, I gather. That
absolutely,
that
Your Honor.
It would be an unusual delay here in being able to get the warrant process completed, and that necessitated
taking a swift They were concerned because of that length of time. He would have to go to the bathroom. He might do this. He might do that. Evidence might get destroyed.
Correct, Your Honor.
And Detective Marchak, in terms of the rubbing of the hands inside the pocket, I think he said, he testified he was picking at his hands, looking at his hands. I could see him rubbing his fingers. When his hands are crossed, he then put his hands into his pocket, and you could see movement within that.
Okay.
So which pocket?
I don't know.
We don't know.
I don't know. I may have to watch it again. Do your honors have any further questions about any of the
inevitable discovery? I'd love to. I'd love to hear about inevitable discovery.
You want to hear about inevitable discovery?
Yeah, I'd like to.
Inevitable discovery is, in terms of the record, we actually have Judge Jimenez finding that defendant would have been incarcerated at the county jail. And that during processing, his clothing would have been seized. So there is in the record a basis to apply inevitable discovery. I still firmly believe that search incident to arrest is the first exception that is surely applicable, given that we have the arrest and the delay was reasonable, and that's the standard for that's for the delay. You have to explain what caused the delay, and as Your Honor just pointed out, the police were taking steps. They were taking steps to get a warrant.
That seems to be related to, they would have gotten a search warrant anyway, would have gotten the clothing pursuant to the search warrant, irrespective of what was going to happen at the county jail.
Correct.
So what are you relying on for inevitable discovery? What was going to happen at the county jail, or they were in the process of getting a search warrant, and it was just being delayed, and that endangered the evidence?
Well, which I think one? Both. I think.
All right, which one do you want to rely on right now? Can I ask you the question? Keep in mind that they're arguing you never suggested that inevitable discovery is related to what would happen at the county jail.
I don't agree with that.
I know, but they're arguing that. So give me the search warrant aspect of it.
Okay. Well, there is enough for the search warrant because we have in the record that the police were in the process of attempting to get search warrants, and they did get them at about 8:30. Which was only about an hour and a half after the removal of the clothing took place.
Ms. McClain said that in the cases where that's been considered to constitute inevitable discovery, there have been two sets of officers. The left hand and the right hand don't know what one another is doing. Is that the state of the law? Is it limited to that kind of situation, or does it go beyond?
I don't necessarily agree with that. I don't think it has to get down to that level of detail. I think there's enough in this record to show that steps were being made, reasonable steps were being made, but it was primarily due to the number of officers that were doing other things, the approval process. Prosecutors have to approve these search warrants, the court smart machine not working. And it adds up in terms of the time, and the more time passed, it feeds into Judge Sabatino's, the whole issue of exigent circumstances.
You said you disagree that you waived inevitable discovery as to the jail. So where did you previously mention inevitable discovery at the jail?
I cite to Judge Jimenez's first initial opinion. He talks about processing the defendant where his clothes would be taken. I also cited in my brief.
Before you leave that, can a trial court's comment about what his experience or her experience might be, substitute for the state in this case having actually raised the issue?
I think so, because in this case, Judge, and this was one issue that, you know, in terms of what happened in Torres 1, the Appellate Division completely ignored the state's exigency argument.
But on the other hand, you're arguing that the defendant at the trial level waived the strip search issue by not affirmatively arguing that a strip search was a basis to find this unconstitutional.
Well, the prosecutor at the, although she didn't articulate and actually use the magic words exigency or exigent circumstances, she did make articulate an exigency.
I'm not talking about exigency. Okay. I'm talking about inevitable discovery, because I think you're saying the judge talked about, I had the sense from that discussion, he was talking about his own experience and being aware of the rules. But that's a substitute for the state raising it. But is it consistent to say the judge talked about it, therefore it's immaterial that the state didn't raise it, and yet at the same time say that the defendant waived the issue?
I do have in my procedural history that the state did raise inevitable discovery, but it wasn't.
But they argue that it wasn't as to the jail. Right. They say that you only raise it as to the warrant.
There were two different categories of inevitable discovery that have found their way.
Yeah, I understand.
Case.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Although, is that, I guess, similar to an argument about, well, you know, they mentioned the word strip search, but they didn't cite the guidelines or the statute, and so they should be precluded from citing the guidelines or the statute now. I think it all depends at the level of generality at which you're saying that the precise argument has to be made.
Granted. And I think that's the state's, if you want to walk away from this case, it's just that the strip search statute does not apply, that search incident to arrest is the pathway, so to speak, in terms of taking the defendants, of seizing the clothing. We also have probable cause and exigency to seize the sweatshirt. And at the end of the day, that was the only, as I started my opening, that was the only piece of incriminating evidence for which the exclusionary rule would apply to. So everything that occurred afterward, it would be subject perhaps to a civil lawsuit, a 1983 action or something like that, but the exclusionary rule would only apply to a constitutional or statutory violation, which in this record, really, there's really nothing here in terms of that the police, because at the end of the day, and I think Edwards is a great opinion, it really talks about reasonableness. And I also cite the Appellate Division opinion in State versus Lentz, which is cited in our brief and as well as the public defender's brief, that really encapsulates a very similar scenario. You had a 2.5-hour delay. You had someone arrested for something unrelated to the actual police investigation. And at the end of the day, the court said, you know, we think that the delay was reasonable. We think that the scope of the search was reasonable. And that's all I have.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Ms. McLean, rebuttal?
I promise to go quickly.
Okay. Take your time.
Go quickly. Just kidding.
All right. As to the, is everything from the first appeal, not the first appeal, because it's the same appeal, in my opinion, but is everything from active opinion one not before this court? It is before this court. If this court disagrees, though, then all of the arguments in my brief about how this is not permissible as a search incident to arrest still apply and are still before the court and dictate suppression. As for inevitable discovery about the jail, the state bears the burden of proof. A trial judge's factual findings have to be based in evidence, not in guessing, not in other things. And insofar as the judge said, well, probably the jail would have taken his clothes, that's not an appropriate factual finding. That's a guess, and courts can't guess in favor of the party with the burden of proof. We don't know if someone's family could have gotten his clothing. We don't know what would have happened, and courts cannot go back and fill in the record in favor of the party with the burden of proof. As to inevitable discovery in that we would have gotten a warrant, the state can't prove that. So, in, for example, the paradigmatic inevitable discovery case is Nix. We have officers who did an illegal thing, found out the location of a body. We have a wholly independent grid search that was moving along towards the body. If officer group one hadn't done that, group two would have found that. That's what would have discovered the evidence independently of the illegality looks like.
And that's a very stark example of inevitable discovery, but it is not the only category of conduct that gives rise to inevitable discovery. And we do have these cases involving efforts to get a warrant.
Correct, but the question is, can the state prove by clear and convincing evidence that these officers would have followed the specific investigatory procedures in light of the fact that they were faced with that opportunity and they chose not to? They chose to preempt the search warrant. They chose to search him.
But we have a whole process going on during which they are, because there's no other reason to do it, contacting the prosecutor, the sheriff's department, and the court over a course of about 2 hours to get a search warrant. We know that's going on before they take the clothing and while they take the clothing, right?
So is that right? I think we have a difference of opinion as to what counts as in the process of getting a search warrant.
Were they talking to the prosecutor?
They had spoken to the prosecutor and say, prosecutor, we wanted a search warrant.
Had the prosecutor or the prosecutor, contacted the court the first time? There's a record of it.
I apologize. I can look at the exact order, but my understanding is they told the prosecutor, we want a search warrant. The prosecutor was off doing the things the prosecutor was going to do. The officers who did conduct this search had not yet spoken to a judge. They conducted the search as seen in the police reports attached to the state's appellate division brief in anticipation of that search warrant. And you can't search in anticipation of a search warrant. That's not how...
Presumably a search not knowing that a search warrant is being applied for, so... In your example, there are two independent arms of law enforcement. One's going to get a search warrant. The other one has no idea it's going on. That's a worse scenario than what we've described here.
Well, what we have here is officers who correctly identified the thing they were supposed to do, get a judge on the phone, explain their probable cause, get prior authorization to do this search.
And then they did get it, though, about an hour and a half after the search was completed. So just reading from the language of, I think it's State versus Sugar, to satisfy the inevitable discovery exception to the exclusionary rule, the state must show proper, normal, and specific investigatory procedures would have been pursued in order to complete the investigation in the case. Here they actually were pursued, so we know they obviously would have been pursued because they were already pursuing them and they continued to pursue them. Under all of the surrounding relevant circumstances, the pursuit of those procedures would have inevitably resulted in the discovery of the evidence. They did get a warrant, and had they waited and done the search at 8:31, with the warrant in hand, they would have ended up with the exact same thing that they ended up with. And three, the discovery of the evidence through the use of such procedures would have occurred wholly independently of the discovery of such evidence by unlawful means. So had they waited until 8:31, it would have had nothing to do with anything that happened before. That all seems true. So I agree with you, it's an odd circumstance, and it's not when inevitable discovery is generally raised. But because they were applying for a warrant, or they were attempting to apply for a warrant, and because they got a warrant, how would this have been any different had the search had been, had, I'm sorry, the sweatshirt had been taken at 8:31 as opposed to 6:42?
It wouldn't have violated defendant's right to be free from an unreasonable search and seizure. That's the difference. The That's
true of every inevitable discovery case.
And for that reason, the state bears a higher burden of proof. They have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the police would have done the right thing. The state can't come up
you
and say...
You think that didn't happen here, even though they did get the warrant?
Even though they did do the right thing. Thing is, what's necessary to apply for the warrant? Here they did do that, in that they did get the warrant.
After the fact.
You're saying the right thing is to wait.
I'm guessing the Office of the Public Defender does not want a ruling that officers can search in anticipation of getting a search warrant when they should have a search warrant in hand. I think that's where.
Yes,
we are,
thank you, right? Your Honor. Thank you. I appreciate it.
But, yes. Because that would.
That would.
Getting a searching would, in anticipation of a search warrant is not obtaining a search warrant.
Yes, thank you. I apologize.
In the cases where this has been recognized as a basis for inevitable discovery, the focus, as I recall those cases, is on the correctness of the steps that were taken. So if they're trying to say we would have gotten a warrant because, you know, by Tuesday we would have thought of it, and there are no steps being taken, generally that's not going to work. But when you have concrete concrete steps that are underway, are they the correct steps?
But here the question is, would they have waited? And we know the answer to that. The answer is no.
I understand. You're saying waiting would be, it's your contention, and you're not going to budge from it, nor should you, that the correct steps would be waiting. But we have recognized in a number of settings that when the process is underway and correct steps are being taken, that inevitable discovery can apply.
I think those circumstances are rare, and I don't think they apply in this case.
But even if we don't put it, I hate to prolong it, but one last thing. If we don't categorize it as an inevitable discovery argument, and we just look at Edwards, and one of the factors is, was there an unreasonable delay in the situation? The 2 hours it was taking to get a warrant, it was very unusual, and wouldn't that analytically be relevant, whether you agree it's enough or not is something else, but analytically, isn't it relevant, the time it was taking to try to get the warrant, to whether the state can justify the delay under the search incident to arrest exception?
So under Edwards, I think the facts of Edwards are actually really illustrative of why what happened here is wrong. In Edwards, delaying the search was the more reasonable choice. The delay, doing the search later as opposed to immediately, was more reasonable because if they'd done it immediately, they didn't have clothes for the defendant. He would have been naked in a cell all night. So they waited until they had replacement clothes. And under those circumstances, that's what a reasonable delay looks like. It looks like,
yeah, they had a jumpsuit he was going to go into when he got into the jail. I mean, that's a non-issue here. If they had to wait till he got to the jail another hour or so, and then he changed, and then they took him, factually, that's essentially no different than what happened here.
Two problems. First, this...
I didn't mean to jump on you with that.
No, this kind of, we had to do it now, there's a reason we had to do it now, we couldn't possibly carry on waiting like we were supposed to do, is in deep, deep tension with this idea that, oh, don't worry, we would have gotten it no matter what when he showed up at the jail, whenever he showed up at the jail. These two things are in tension, they can't both be true. And as for the jail search, we're guessing. There is no evidence on this record, the state has not presented any evidence, the trial court's guessing as to what could have happened at a jail isn't good enough for the state to meet a burden of proof.
At some point, I thought you were arguing that the search happened too late, not too early. So I thought your brief said, you know, had they seized the sweatshirt as soon as he was arrested, that would have been completely fine. The issue here is that they waited. That's what I didn't understand, because it seemed like it was only during the interview or interrogation. It was only during the interrogation that they saw him doing things that they thought were attempting to destruct biological evidence. And then as soon as the interview was over, it seems like it should be your office's position that one officer can't just decide on their own to strip search someone and take their clothing or even to take someone's sweatshirt. Instead, they should have to check with their chain of command. They should have to check with the prosecutor. They should have to do all of the things that the detectives were doing. So it seems
very odd to me for you to say they could have done everything that they did at 3 p.m., but because they waited until 6:42 p.m., that's the problem, even though in waiting, they were doing what one would want police to do.
The reason is because a search incident to arrest, the default rule is it has to be contemporaneous with the arrest. That's what
they're...
That's what the U.S. Supreme Court has held in Schimmel. That's what this court has held.
In Edwards,
they
two and a half hours later was fine.
I thought it was 10 hours.
It was 10 hours later in Edwards. But this is where you get into this exception for delayed searches that are nonetheless constitutionally reasonable.
So this is too late in your theory. This case it's too late for search instance for arrest, and it's premature on the inevitable discovery aspect as to the warrant. It's kind of a Goldilocks situation.
My primary position is this was a strip search and you can't do it incident to arrest. If we're in this universe where we can somehow separate the police actions into component parts, then hypothetically the police could have taken the zippered sweatshirt when they arrested him if they believed incident to his arrest, because the purpose of a search incident to arrest is to prevent the defendant from gaining access to a weapon he could use, to a means of escape, to destructible evidence. He's been in continuous police custody. The risk, any risk that it has existed, has been safely handled. It's been dealt with. It has been being dealt with for 3 hours.
Why? What if the risk is is biological evidence is very delicate and it can dissipate? And so it actually does make a difference. You know, if you go to the bathroom and spill water all over your sweatshirt where there was blood, maybe that actually would matter one way or the other.
I think we get into a different, perhaps closer call if the defendant asks to go to the bathroom. I think you could, you know, take his sweatshirt. At that point, there he might be closer to an immediate, a compelling state need. But nothing had changed at 6:40 p.m. when they decided to take all of his clothing. Nothing had changed other than they decided to stop waiting for a search warrant, which is what they were supposed to do. Warrantless searches are supposed to be the exception, not the rule. They're presumptively unreasonable. And you can't search in anticipation of a warrant. You can't strip search people incident to arrest. You can't use the search incident to arrest exception to allow wide-ranging searches hours and hours after an arrest. It untethers the exception from its core purposes, and this court should not allow that to occur under our Constitution.
Thank you, Ms. McClain, and thank you to all counsel. Excellent argument.